It's air-conditioned, though, and there's a nice terrace overlooking the good-sized pool and the ocean. We went down for breakfast this morning and tried our luck with the hot drinks machine. The milk seems to be an optical illusion. It comes out of the spout but disappears as soon as it makes contact with the coffee. On leaving, we saw Italians bringing their cups up to the bar, which is apparently what you need to do if you want a real latte. When Dario drove us into the city of Alghero, Hugh said, "Oh, it looks just like Mogadishu." I haven't been to Mogadishu, so to me it resembles Utah, but with a beach. Manuela and Dario are in the next town over, staying at his parents' place. It's a boxy, one-story house set in a grove of olive trees. There's greenery, but it's all sage-colored. I'm used to the walls and hedges in France, and the landscape here strikes me as mean. It's dry and dusty and full of things that can hurt you. Packs of wild German shepherds run around at night. There are lizards and snakes. Even the birds seem to have a chip on their shoulders. We went to the beach yesterday afternoon with Manuela, and it was packed, wall to wall. The crowd didn't bother me. Rather, I enjoyed being pressed against so many people. The women behind us, all in their 50s with dark, leathery skin, rattled on, and I guessed they were trashing someone. When people speak Italian, I always imagine they're either gossiping or relating the details of a close race. There were many women in bikinis, but no one was topless. A lot of the men wore tiny swimsuits. The water was warm, l'acqua era calda, and you could see to the bottom. I went out beyond the boats with Hugh but got dizzy and nauseated after the first 200 feet. It's the bobbing up and down that gets me. We went to the beach at around 4:30 and stayed for 3 hours or so. At the snack bar, I practiced my Italian. "Two bottles of water," I said, learning as the man got them that it comes in a box. We'd worked fairly hard on our language lessons before arriving, but now it seems futile. I got to say La Domicilia and La Ferma this morning while renting my bike. It's a 10-speed with normal handlebars, and I liked it a lot. After paying, Hugh, Dario, and I went to buy a few things at the market. It was noticed that my bike light didn't work, and Hugh told me no less than 15 times that I had to take it back and have the guy fix it. When he started in for the 16th time, I said, "Okay, you can stop talking now." This doesn't mean shut up exactly. Well, yes, I guess it does. I went back to the bike shop and used the word torcia. The kid was very nice and fixed it so that now the light cannot be turned off. I wanted to say something while he was working, ask a question, make a comment, but I don't know the words for that kind of thing. It made me remember when I first came to France and learned to point out the objects in a room. Still, though, I guess the little bit I know is better than none at all. August 20th. I sat in a lounge chair yesterday afternoon and got a tan on my forehead. Today I'll try to get one on my back and chest. I'm the color of a French chicken and really stand out here. The people surrounding the pool are impossibly brown. They arrive in the morning and roast until 6 at night, pausing every now and then to bob around in the water. I haven't seen anyone use sunscreen. Neither have I seen anyone with a burn. I guess it's their skin. What little tan I get will start to peel within a few days, so the only souvenir of my vacation will be the scrapes and bruises I sustained during last night's bike accident. According to the Herald Tribune, millions of Italians returned from their vacations yesterday. Alghero seems a little less full this afternoon, but it was by no means empty. It was my job to find a place for lunch, so after riding around for a while, I settled on a restaurant called Mazzini. It wasn't fancy. In the corner, a TV played dubbed American soap operas. People always complain that the French are rude, but I found the Italians to be much colder than Parisians. The hotel desk clerks are nice, but in the stores and cafes, they've all been blustery. Our waitress acted as though we'd singled her out for some terrible punishment. But then we noticed that she treated everyone the same way. She was maybe 20 years old, pretty. At the next table, a group of three working men attacked huge plates of spaghetti and mussels, followed by big cuts of grilled meat. I ordered a seafood antipasto, followed by what I thought was spaghetti and octopus. Pulpa sounds to me like it ought to be octopus. I think the waitress made a mistake, as what I received was a plate of red-sauced spaghetti heaped with crabs. They were small, the size of a 50-cent piece, and each one had been hacked in two. One normally doesn't eat the entire crab, and besides that, these were hard, with shells. I guess they'd just been used to flavor the sauce. Hugh tried picking apart some of the tiny claws, but it was too much effort for the stingy reward. Still, though, it was good. A tableful of sailors came in during the Bold and the Beautiful, and were followed by a young couple whose hand-holding suggested that they might be on vacation. We were the only Americans, except for the people on TV. August 24th, Paris. Yesterday morning, Hugh and I watched an Italian man go for a swim with his dog, a yellow lab with bruised-looking teats. He'd just come out of the ocean and was standing on the rocks when a second man confronted him and said, I imagine, that animals were forbidden on the beach. The two men argued back and forth, and then the second guy stomped off and returned 10 minutes later with the scroll. I'm guessing it was a town charter. He unrolled it, but the first man was unimpressed, and the subsequent argument lasted for half an hour. What amazed me was the second guy's tenacity. I'm not sure what reaction he was hoping for, but he seemed determined to get it. August 29th, La Bagotière. In search of a bicycle, Hugh and I went to Super Spur in Flair. The store is situated in an ugly industrial park on the outskirts of town. The lighting was harsh and fell on rack after rack of cheap sweatshirts and ugly nylon tracksuits. They didn't have much in the way of bikes, and had I been more patient, we would have left and visited one of the stores in town. It was Monday, though, and everything else was closed. I wanted something right away, so after trying out a Raleigh 5-speed, merchandise is not allowed to leave the store, so I was reduced to tooling up and down the aisles like a bear in a circus, I settled on a Jetan 7-speed with normal handlebars. It wasn't expensive, $300, but leaving the store, I felt I'd betrayed the bike I already own. If I'd gotten new tires and brake pads for it, I would have been fine. What are called modernizations on the more recent models seem nothing more than an attempt by the manufacturers to save money. The current fenders and foot pedals are made out of plastic, as are the gear wheels and air pumps. In a fire, my new bike would melt into a puddle. It came with a front and rear light, but I don't imagine they'll last long. The seats and handlebars are so easily adjustable that they loosen at the slightest provocation, and I worry I'll have to carry a tool set at all times. The chain came off before I left Flair, and I think it's going to take me a while to master the gears. I don't mean to sound so down on it. I guess I just feel guilty. The lines at Super Spur were long and slow. Families were buying back-to-school clothes, and every few minutes the cashier had to leave her post and answer the ringing telephone behind another register. I had to go to the bathroom, so while Hugh headed home in the car, I rode to a McDonald's located at the far end of the industrial park. I'd occasionally eat at one in Paris, but the second time I was laughed at by the counter help, I stopped going. I guess I'd been saying something wrong, but to my mind, Big Mac is an American term and should be pronounced as such. At the Flair McDonald's, I ordered a filter coffee, which is hard to find in France. It was 5 o'clock, the place was practically empty, and the girl behind the counter was exceedingly pleasant. They were offering the McDonald's Maxi Best Special, a Royale cheese, large fries, and the soda of your choice for 37 francs, a little over $5, which would be expensive for the States. Inside the Flair McDonald's, there were local newspapers mounted on bamboo canes. There were display cases offering a clear view of the latest toys, but there were no ashtrays. In order to smoke, one had to step out onto the playground. A family sat on the far end of the slide, both the parents and the teenagers puffing away. I'd been there for a few minutes when the counter girl ran out with their orders. In America, you'd have to stand by the register and wait, but I guess in Flair they're willing to come to you. The family received their Maxi Best Specials and regarded them while they finished their cigarettes. The industrial park emptied, and beyond the fence, cars passed on the way home from work. This being France, I know I'm supposed to sit in cafes with thimble-sized cups of espresso. I'm supposed to return day after day until the owner finally consents to shake my hand and ask how it's going. But I couldn't have been happier than I was at my ugly little McDonald's. It was the coffee I wanted, with no fear that the waiter would ignore me. I paid immediately and didn't have to beg for my check. Plus, I got to watch a toddler whiz down a slide onto a carpet of cigarette butts. I'm thinking that I might make that McDonald's my place. October 8th, Paris. Stephen Barclay told me that the building our new apartment is in was the original site of Sylvia Beach's Shakespeare and Company bookstore. Hugh looked it up on his computer and found pictures of her and various literary celebrities standing before what is now the ground floor hair salon. I've never been terribly interested in that crowd, but still it's impressive that James Joyce stood drunk and probably peed in our stairway. Hugh was thinking we can exploit our location and make money renting out our apartment under the name Finnegan's Sleep. October 12th, New York. The general agreement is that I've lost too much weight. For me, the process has been gradual, but for those I haven't seen in a while, the change is drastic. People who hadn't been told about my diet probably imagine that I have either AIDS or cancer, which is a pretty good definition of bad weight loss. Andy couldn't bring himself to look me in the eye. It's as if I'd had a disfiguring accident and everyone's trying to pretend they don't notice it. It's not the reaction I'd expected at all. I went to Little Brown and talked to H, who filled me in on the new Kevin Aucoin book. The other night, just before his appearance at Barnes & Noble, he called saying he'd need a bodyguard. He's not snippy, but says these things in all sincerity. He needed the bodyguard in case the NRA decided to retaliate for a remark he'd made in a Time Out interview. To him, it made perfect sense that the National Rifle Association might send a hitman to kill Cher's makeup artist. His political views are too extreme, and sooner or later the Republicans will have to silence him. H denied the request for a bodyguard, so Kevin hired his own. He's going next week to his hometown in Louisiana and called to demand that Little Brown arrange to award him the keys to the city. The keys to the city don't really count if you have to ask for them yourself. But H went ahead and wrote to the mayor. Last night, Kevin was supposed to be at Bendel's from 5 to 9 and decided to show up at around 8. I love hearing about this guy. October 16th, Philadelphia. There's a scale in the hotel bathroom, and I found out that I weigh 131 pounds. The last time I weighed in, I was 157, but that was before moving to France. 131 is too low. It's a weakling's weight. I'd like to get up to 140 but still have a flat stomach and a 30-inch waist. Is that possible? October 20th, Springfield, Missouri. Springfield has got to be the most depressing city in the United States. The trip from the airport to the hotel was hideous, and things didn't improve much between here and Hammond's Hall. The land is flat and covered with failed strip malls and chain stores surrounded by empty parking lots. From my window, I can see a big Kmart, aren't they all big? A Walmart, an Aldi, an AutoZone, a Donut Connection, a Master Wang's Chinese restaurant, a Western Sizzlin', and a Git and Go. Most towns have such a strip, but here even the McDonald's is failing to thrive. You get the idea people would leave if they could only sell their houses and summon up the energy to pack. Branson, Missouri is 45 miles to the south, and the fact is heavily advertised. It's aspiring to be the new country music capital, and the Springfield roads are hugged by billboards for the Osmond Family Theater, the Grand Mansion, the Grand Palace, Bonnybrook Park, Shepherd of the Hills Outdoor Christian Theater, the Dixie Stampede, and the Dewey Short Visitor Center. I've chosen to take my few days off in Chicago, but actually wouldn't have minded going to Branson to see one of the two musicals based on the life of Jesus. I could then see Andy Williams and Jeff Foxworthy at the Grand Palace and eat dinner at Buckingham's Restaurant in Oasis. Then again, On Wednesday, my watch broke, so yesterday I went across the street to the saddest mall in America. Half the stores were shuttered up, and the fountain had been drained. The food court was gone except for a place called Granny's Fudgery, a wooden cart surrounded by card tables. I imagine the mall started going downhill when it accepted Walmart as a tenant. Anything you could find at Bill's card shop and the record bin could also be found there, where a customer could pay less and buy everything in one shot. I'd been to only one Walmart in my life before this, and I was shocked at how ugly it was, even by American standards. It was a mammoth jumble of absolute shit, made more chaotic by brightly colored signs and promotional displays. Yesterday's Walmart was even worse than the first, but the employees were incredibly friendly. Maybe that's normal, but I think my 2 years in Europe made it seem even stranger. You'd never get that kind of treatment at Leclerc or any of the other French superstores. The woman at the jewelry counter replaced my battery and seemed genuinely concerned when the watch still failed to work. "What can we do?" she said. "Did you buy this here or at another Walmart? Maybe we can get you a refund." It seemed strange of her to suppose I'd bought my watch at a Walmart, but I imagine her assumptions are most often correct. It's a hideous place, but the people are really nice, even the customers. I also bought a folder, some eucalyptus throat drops, and a cold medication called Zicam that had been recommended by Megan's father. I sprayed it into my nose, and it unclogged within seconds. For one reason or another, I was flown first class from Cleveland to St. Louis and then on to Springfield. I'd never really cared about first class, but yesterday, because I was sick, I really enjoyed it. It was nice to be in a big, comfortable seat and have the row all to myself. The stewardess started serving me as soon as I boarded, and I received tea in a real cup. Passengers on the way to coach looked me up and down and made little comments such as, "I guess I ought to continue on to the poor people section." On the first leg, there were 5 of us in first class. On the second flight, there were 4, including a tall man wearing a brown suit and cowboy boots. The plane took off, and shortly afterward, I turned to find him clipping his toenails. It wasn't a quick effort, but a virtual pedicure, followed by 15 minutes with an emery board and a vigorous buffing session. He spent the entire flight this way, and by the time we landed, the carpet at his feet was littered with fine dust and nail trimmings. Because of my cold, my ears stopped up upon landing. It was an odd sensation, and I spent my hour and a half layover straining to hear the boarding announcements. It was as if I had a pillow over my head. The St. Louis airport has those glass smoking tanks, and the ashtrays are regularly emptied. October 30th, San Francisco. I couldn't smoke in Bob and Lisa's house, so we set up a sewing table on the deck where I could sit and work. Yesterday morning, I got up early and had just finished my first cup of coffee when I realized the door had locked behind me. It was 7:30, and I felt certain that if I waited a few minutes, Bob would come down to let his dog out. Jessie, their border collie, made an appearance at around 8, and we regarded one another through the glass door. I hoped that envy might drive her to start barking, but aside from one quick yip, she kept her mouth shut. It was cold but not freezing, and I'd dressed in a sweatshirt and a black jacket Lisa's mother-in-law had sent her the day before. Operating on the insane hope that maybe the door was set on some kind of timer, I got up from the sewing machine and tried to reopen it every few minutes. To the neighbors, it must have looked as though I were trying to break in and write about it at the same time, and I worried that one of them might call the police. I waited until around 8:30, and then I jumped off the side of the deck, walked around the house, and rang the front bell. Bob answered in his bathrobe, and I was grateful I'd come to stay with him and Lisa. Were it anyone else in my family, they would have ignored the bell, hoping that whoever it was would eventually give up and go away. November 9th, Greencastle, Indiana. I called Dad last night after dinner. He asked about my visit with Tiffany, and I tried to be positive. She was pretty wound up yesterday, but other than that, she seemed to be on a fairly even keel. It just troubles me that she can live in such filth. On several occasions during my visit, she referred to herself as poor, and that depressed me. Most people would say they're broke, That word suggests a temporary setback. Poor, on the other hand, conveys a permanence. She sees poverty as romantic and claims to be perfectly happy. Last week, she found a frozen turkey in somebody's garbage can. I can see taking it home and using it for target practice, but she took it home and ate it. I hate thinking that someone in my family would eat a turkey found in the garbage. Tiffany uses overhead lights, not caring how harsh they are. She wakes up, and the first thing she does is turn on the TV. Joints are smoked early in the day, and then she gets on the phone and hustles little jobs. On Tuesday, she strips some boards for an odious antiques dealer. There was talk about getting something full-time, maybe with benefits, but I'm guessing she'll find an excuse to reject it. She's not lazy, Tiffany, but she has a hard time dealing with expectations. Robert came by in the evenings, and the two of them sat on the sofa, switching from one station to another and talking through everything. I liked Robert. He seems to genuinely care about her and is a good listener. On Tuesday afternoon, she cried while telling me a story she'd recounted a year before. She cries a lot, and the episodes generally end with a list of things she's doing for herself. I get out of bed in the mornings. Do you understand? I get up. The accomplishments are tiny, but I guess they're all she's got. November 10th, Chicago. Televisions at the Indianapolis airport showed that Bush was ahead by 210 votes, with one district left to recount. Who ever thought that the presidential election would come down to the number of people you'd find in a movie theater? It might be resolved tonight, but I doubt it. I like the Star Market in Somerville, and was surprised that Tiffany goes instead to the corner store in her neighborhood, which is much more expensive. Even a coffee pot would save her money, but instead she makes it by the cup. I always thought that Dad would be good at teaching low-income people how to grocery shop. He's smart with coupons and bulk buying, but when you have no money and are miserable, I guess you can't get too worked up over a 10-pound bag of pinto beans. When I was broke, I shopped very carefully, but then again, I was never clinically depressed. I keep reflecting on my conversations with Tiffany, and it's frustrating. The slightest hint of criticism sends her over the edge, so I would wind up saying nothing. It's probably for the best, as most people don't really want advice. November 19th, New York. After landing in Denver, I ran to the smoking lounge where I saw a woman hotboxing a cigarette while pushing a baby confined to a wheelchair. Bringing ordinary children into the smoking lounge is enough to earn you glares, but a baby in a wheelchair could possibly lead to a lynching. Boy, that took nerve. December 14th, Paris. Apparently, I don't have AIDS. The French bank received my blood test and approved my mortgage, so though I haven't yet read it on a piece of paper, I'm guessing I'm negative. This is sort of major, as for the past 15 years I've just naturally assumed I was infected. Every time I sweat at night, every time I get a sore or run a fever, I think that it's finally kicked in. It wasn't always at the front of my mind, but it was always there. It sounds goofy, but it's going to take a while for the news to sink in. I'm not disappointed. I just need to figure out what to do between now and the time I develop cancer. Sophie and Philippe picked me up in a taxi, and we went to a TV station in an ugly suburb. This was for a cable program called Paris Première, hosted by a handsome anchorman who stood at a desk and read from slips of paper rather than a monitor. I'd been offered the option of speaking in English, but I just went ahead and did it in French. The segment lasted maybe 5 minutes, and it passed quickly. I then had my makeup removed and watched on the monitors as the host had a fit and yelled at the cameraman. There was something wrong with the placement of an object, and when it happened a second time, he got even uglier. It was fun. My 7 o'clock interview was canceled, so after the TV appearance, Sophie and I went to the office where I signed 30 books and then walked home. Apparently, the Supreme Court ruled in Bush's favor, so last night Al Gore conceded. I had to call Dad for some information, and the conversation got scary when he started talking about the election. He's always been a Republican, but it saddened me when he started quoting Rush Limbaugh and trashing what he called the liberal mainstream media. It's always the paper's fault. Conservatives tell the truth, everyone else lies. Dad was foaming at the mouth over how Gore tried to steal the election. "I've been so upset I haven't been able to sleep," he said. Last night, Hugh went to dinner with Leslie and paid $130 for a baked potato wrapped in aluminum foil. It came accompanied by a teaspoon of caviar. There was a bowl of borscht and a tiny dessert, but still, the centerpiece was a 35-cent potato. He was shocked by the price and tried to justify it by saying that in the past, Leslie had often paid for his dinner. He'd saved money over the years, and now he was spending a little. "Yes, but for a potato?" "And I got to sit next to Yves Saint Laurent," he said. This still didn't justify the $130, and he knew it. Besides, 10 minutes after taking his seat, Yves Saint Laurent signaled the waiter and asked to be moved. For the past week, he has been painting for Diane Johnson, and the potato amounted to 2 days' worth of work. January 13th, Paris. Yesterday at Chopie, I noticed a black man wearing a crocheted jester's hat and bell-bottom jeans trimmed in lace. The first time I saw him, he was looking at fish and pushing a baby carriage. I dismissed him as a nut, but then I decided he was just a father, maybe a musician. At the fruit and vegetable scales, I stepped over to look at the child and saw that it was a doll. White, maybe 2 feet tall, and dressed in a hooded down jacket. It wasn't a baby, but a little girl with matted blonde hair that had obviously been washed with soap. Amy and I stood behind the man in line and listened as he held a conversation with her. "Hello," he said, and then, in a higher voice, "I need gloves." It was, he explained, his daughter talking. "She is cold tonight, but so is everyone." The man said that he and Michael Jackson were both fathers and that it was a lot harder than it looked. He kissed the doll on the head and told me that portable phones had improved the world's mood. In the 1960s, everyone was very serious, but now, due to technology, people were lightening up. The doll complained about the long wait, and he comforted her, saying they'd be home soon. The man was buying 2 whole trout and 4 cartons of orange juice. He was very nice to the cashier, and she was nice back, each of them wishing the other a happy new year. I told the story to Manuela last night, and she accused me of making it up. Then I told the story of Chantal's father beating his dog to death with a stick. He was there to back me up, which ultimately made my doll story more credible. Plus, I had Amy as an eyewitness. January 22nd. We had dinner at Peggy's with Armistead and an American painter named Richard. Stephen had told me about him, but it didn't register until he mentioned he'd inherited the estate of the surrealist painter Leonor Feeney. At one point, the conversation turned to a San Francisco cellist named Dorothy. "Oh, I'd love to go to her house," Peggy said. "She's bald." I love the way her mind works. Later, she told a story about her and her best friend Flicka dating a pair of Samoan cousins when they were in their 20s. The guy she went out with was named Ziki Fuapopo, and the story she told involved his mother, a pile of cocaine, and a group of men dressed in lava lavas. March 21st, New York. It's been 2 years since I've had a drink. Amy gave me a bathroom scale for an anniversary present, and without my shoes, I weigh 132. The other day in Greencastle, I weighed 144, so I'm figuring one of the scales must be wrong. He will give me a present tonight when he gets home, and maybe this evening I'll have a piece of cake. It's almost best not to mention it, as any celebration of sobriety seems so painfully childlike. I know, I'll have a tea party and invite all my invisible friends. April 10th, San Francisco. After last night's reading, Ronnie, Blair, and I went to dinner with a critical care nurse who's in the process of writing 2 novels and told me that in 80% of all burglaries, the intruder defecates on the bed. If not the bed, he'll shit on the carpet or the dining room table. It's done as a final fuck you to the homeowner, but seems like an awful lot of trouble. It's hard enough to use a strange toilet, let alone a mattress or carpet, so why bother? Do the burglars save up, or can they just defecate on command? Is this a trick they learned in prison? April 30th, Paris. On the front door of a restaurant, I saw a sign reading, Dinners, Lunches, Receptions. It's hard to say the word lunches with the missing E. Lunches. The city of Paris is continuing last year's ad campaign. The goal is to get people to clean up after their dogs, and the billboards read, You have good reason not to pick up. He does it very well in your place. One ad pictures a child sitting on the grass and using a cookie cutter on a Great Dane-sized pile of shit. Another, my favorite, shows a blind man with six good-sized stools speared on his cane. Shit isn't terribly photogenic, and the stools come off looking like the grilled sausages served at one of the many Greek restaurants off Saint Michel. May 3rd. I had an interview with a German man who writes for the equivalent of the Ladies' Home Journal. He was a portly fellow with white teeth and glasses who wore a button-down shirt and a new pair of Levi's. He told me that his sister is clinically depressed and read naked during a month-long visit to a psychiatric hospital. According to him, once she'd finished, she loaned it to a fellow patient who, in turn, loaned it to someone else. The book seemed to lift people's spirits, and as a result, the hospital has made it recommended reading. I'm not sure whether I believe this, but it's extremely flattering to think my book is being passed around a German asylum. May 5th, La Bagotière. Until last night, we slept on a bed that came with the house and felt as though it had been stuffed with marshmallows. We'd lie down and roll to the middle, where we'd sink to the bottom and wake up feeling like someone had taken to us with a stick. I've been offering to buy a new bed, and finally, Hugh accepted. We went to Le Page and Flair, an ugly aluminum-sided building filled with equally ugly furniture. Our salesman was a small man with blonde hair, who invited us upstairs and pointed out the various features of the display models. Allez-y, he said. The beds had plastic pads at the feet so you could test them out without soiling the mattresses. Hugh went from one to another and lay down, looking as though he'd been sent to his room. He eventually chose the hardest, and as we went downstairs to pay, the salesman sussed us out, asking if the two of us looked forward to our good night's sleep. This was surprising, as it fell under the category of a personal question. The two of you implied that we might be sleeping together, and he said it sneakily. I don't mind a personal question, but Hugh does. And rather than answer, he walked away to inspect the fake leather footrest that resembled a half-deflated medicine ball. Yes, well, the salesman said. The mattress and box spring were on sale and came to $800. A delivery was arranged, and as I handed over my credit card, I noticed the salesman's startling B.O. It always shocks me when someone smells like that and wears a suit. A delivery man brought the mattress at 5:30, and the two of us spent the evening looking forward to bedtime. Hugh turned in at midnight and had a great night's sleep. I went to bed at 1 and lay awake for hours, feeling as though I were stretched out on a length of pavement. The mattress is too hard for my taste, and I woke up with a sore jaw, having dreamt I'd been hit by a car. May 12th, Atlantic Beach. When at Dad's house, one drinks coffee from a Rush Limbaugh mug. Walking to the kitchen for a refill involves passing a thank you card from George Bush and Dick Cheney, who stand embracing each other. Dad wanted me to ride to the beach with him, but I just couldn't. Why the hell not? He asked. I looked at his Honda Civic, the seats matted with dog hair, and the bumper sticker reading, Al Gore is the risky proposition. I rode with him as far as Paul's and ducked down low in the seat. He started driving like an old person, and I worried it might take days to reach the motel. On the ride from his house to Paul's, he never exceeded 25 miles per hour. May 17th, Paris. I received a long, confusing letter from a German woman that begins, Dear Mr. Sedaris, To be forced expressing myself in English makes me become a daisy, a fatal starting point for me. By the way, I cannot find anything which I could present you as an equal output. I am a petitioner. That's the fact. I'm not sure what she wants, but she mentions Santaland and Season's Greetings, referring to the latter as a cutting, ambiguous, controversial, subtle text giving us laughing the creeps. May 27th, La Bagotière. I biked to Flair and was inching past a red light when I heard someone blow their horn behind me. They honked a second and third time, and I turned to find a police car carrying three officers, two up front and one in the back. You see that a lot here, and it always seems strange to me. The driver yelled, "Hey, that light is red," and I got off my bike and moved it onto the sidewalk, pretending he'd said, "Here's that butcher shop you were looking for." I could physically feel the common, stupid expression on my face, and I stood there, looking in the window at meat until they had passed. May 30th, Paris. One of yesterday's interviewers brought me a Swiss Army knife. She was a small blonde woman from Zurich who arrived complaining about the heat. Complaining is too strong a word. She commented on it, as did the earlier Swiss interviewer. Both journalists found Paris to be boring and asked what I thought of Zurich. I told the second woman that I liked the grocery store at the airport, and she said, "Yes, we all go to the airport on Sunday." "And Paris is boring?" I thought the store was for travelers who wanted to pick up a few things on the way home, but it's actually a way around the Swiss blue laws demanding that shops close from Saturday afternoon until Monday morning. The laws apply everywhere but the airport, so they built a massive supermarket in the Swiss air terminal. "It's the place to be on a Sunday," the woman said. I received a letter from an American woman living in Paris, who wrote to say she'd read my interview in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. "I fully intend to read your book," she said, "as I, too, have hoped to talk pretty someday." It's always queer when people work a book title into a headline or sentence, especially this book title. She wrote about her 2-year-old daughter and their upcoming move and finally got to the point. "My reason for this note is because of your comments on smoking. Because of you and others with similar opinions, people like me cannot eat in Paris restaurants except McDonald's. I hope you are never the victim of a smoking-related illness or have to care for someone who is. Believe me, then talking pretty will not be an option." There's no return address, so she won't be hearing back from me. June 5th, Cleveland, Ohio. I was met at the airport by Marilyn, a widow who looks to be in her early 70s. It was chilly, and she wore a handsome felt coat, along with no fewer than 14 bracelets. Marilyn has a great heap of wild gray hair and wears a sort of heavy-rimmed, round-framed glasses favored by architects. When I told her I wanted to arrive at the bookstore an hour early, she shook her head and said she didn't see the need. "I'll get you there 15 minutes beforehand. That'll give you more than enough time." I've never appeared in a Cleveland bookstore and had no idea what to expect, so I said fine. We arrived at Joseph Beth at 6:45. Pulling into the crowded parking lot, Marilyn suggested that someone in the surrounding neighborhood must be having a party. They do that sometimes and park here illegally. We walked into the store, and she put her hand to her face, saying, "Goodness, they must be having a sale." Susan, the manager, counted 400 people in the audience. I signed for 20 minutes beforehand and 3 hours afterward, and when I was done, the manager gave me a T-shirt. On the way back to the hotel, Marilyn said it was nice that so many people just happened to be in the store. June 10th, Chicago. I'm still not sold on the bow tie and have been asking people for their opinions on it. What do you say, yes or no? I'd worried it suggested a wacky uncle and felt comforted when a woman at Borders said it made me look like a shy scholar. That carried me through to Barbara's, where a young man defined it as the pierced eyebrow of the Republican Party. This should probably put an end to it once and for all. June 12th, Iowa City. The best thing to be said about the Iowa City Sheraton is that it's connected to a fast food concern called TJ Cinnamon's. In my room, there are hairs and flecks of shit clinging to the inside of the toilet bowl. The tub still hasn't drained from last night's bath, and even the complimentary pen is broken. The room service coffee is served with non-dairy creamer, the furniture is stained, and the closet has only one coat hanger in it. Yesterday afternoon, the outdoor temperature reached 100 degrees. I'm guessing it was also 100 in the lobby and hotel restaurant, which were both without air conditioning. All in all, it's the most depressing hotel since the Holiday Inn in Portland, Maine. June 13th, San Francisco. On the way to the bookstore, I asked Frank, the escort, what he thought of my bow tie. He hesitated for a moment and then said, "A bow tie tells the world that the person wearing it can no longer get an erection." June 25th, Paris. While I was gone, Hugh, Manuela, and Dario attended Frank's surprise 40th birthday party. One of the guests was a sophisticated mother of three who announced that she hated the zoo at the Jardin des Plantes because it was cruel to keep the animals in such small cages. She went on, and then, at the end of the evening, she unlocked her car and released her golden retriever, who'd spent the last 6 hours in the trunk. July 13th, Tübingen, Germany. This is my new favorite German city, and it's nice because I didn't really expect it. It's a college town, but the old center is remarkable, crammed with steep-roofed buildings and intersected by a network of streams. Living here would undoubtedly get dull, but it's beautiful to look at. We arrived yesterday afternoon. It was a 3-hour ride involving 2 separate trains and a change in Stuttgart. On our first train, we sat in a smoking compartment and reviewed our evening in Nuremberg. "That couple last night were really trampling on my nerves," Tini said. I just love her English. It's not as grammatically correct as Gert's, but I find it infinitely more charming. On the way to Tübingen, we passed a smokestack with the word "Dick" written on it. July 16th, Paris. While eating, Tini discussed her friend's upcoming move to New York. They're a pair of reporters going from Hamburg to West 68th Street. Hugh said the move will be difficult, especially if they smoke, and Tini said, "No, they have finished their smoking." She said it as though, when born, they'd been allotted a certain number of cigarettes. They'd depleted their supply, and now it's all behind them. Later, she made a reference to the restaurant's delicious smashed potatoes. I called Lisa last night. She's been getting a lot of compliments on her garden, and when she mentioned this to Dad, he said that Gretchen, too, had been spending a lot of time in the yard. Lisa said that Gretchen's garden was mainly wildflowers, and Dad said, "Yes, well, you're you, and Gretchen is extremely creative." She told him that I was number one on the New York Times list, and he said, "Well, he sure isn't number one in the Wall Street Journal." July 21st, La Bagotière. We rode first class from Paris to Briouze, and while it was nothing special, I worry there's no turning back. On the bigger trains, it makes a difference, but on the tiny locals, an upgraded ticket doesn't get you much of anything. The car is a little less crowded, but that's about it. I sat on the aisle and looked across the way at one of the ugliest men I've seen in a long time. He was a short guy, bearded, and his acne-scarred face was cross-hatched with deep creases. It was the sort of face you might find in a Western. He got off in Ville-Dieu and was replaced by an elderly gentleman in a 3-piece suit. In first class, you count on your fellow passengers to make you feel good about yourself. You're supposed to look around with pride, telling yourself that these are your kind of people. The gentleman made me feel good about being in first class, while the prospector had depressed me. Then I got depressed, thinking that I was probably depressing the gentleman in the suit. Then I stepped out of the first-class car and got dirty looks from the people standing in coach. July 22nd. Hugh was proudly cooking with things from his garden, so last night, along with our steaks, we had oddly shaped potatoes and deep-fried zucchini fingers. He also made a 1-2-3-4 cake, which calls for 1 cup of butter, 2 cups of sugar, 3 cups of flour, and 4 eggs. I ate half of it, which amounts to 1 entire stick of butter. We brought some CDs out to the country, and just as we sat down to dinner, I put on Joni Mitchell's Hegira. It came out 25 years ago, when I was living in Mom and Dad's basement. Back in Raleigh, I listened to it at least 1,000 times, fantasizing that I, too, was some shell-shocked traveler running either to or from another doomed relationship. The problem then was that, at the age of 19, I'd never had a relationship. Normally, I'd play the same song over and over, but this was the rare record you could listen to from start to finish, constructing a different imaginary love interest for each song. Hegira was the wrong CD to play at dinner, as Hugh had also grown up on it. We sat at the table, neither of us saying anything until the record had ended. For me, it's ironic that, on a certain level, all my 19-year-old fantasies have come true. All I do is travel from one place to the next, staring out my hotel windows. What's missing, what made the idea so incredibly romantic, was the instability, the series of boyfriends bound to run off with someone else the moment your back is turned. That's the sort of thing you write songs about, not zucchini fingers and a perfect 1-2-3-4 cake sitting in the refrigerator. In that regard, I'm an equal disappointment to the 19-year-old Hugh, who 25 years later sits across from me at the dinner table, kindly allowing me to hit replay after Song for Sharon. July 31st, Paris. Our next-door neighbor returned yesterday afternoon to complain about the noise. Hugh was chipping out the wall behind the bookcase, and I was in the bedroom, waxing the floors. I missed the whole thing, which is good, as hopefully she'll forget what I looked like. The woman works at home and wanted to know when the noise would end. She wanted a definite cutoff point. So Hugh told her he'd be finished by 4 o'clock. She said that contractors should put up signs stating that the noise would start on one date and end on another, which would be great, but is never going to happen. We'd been told the work on our apartment would end in April, and here it is, almost August. The woman then started in on the building across the street, and Hugh cut her off, saying that she was bothering him just as the noise was bothering her. He won't own up to it, but I'm assuming he shut the door in her face. A few months back, while they were installing the bathtub, we were visited by our neighbor on the other side, a man in his 40s. He complained about the noise, saying that he didn't get off work until after midnight and couldn't show up at his job with circles under his eyes. Hugh asked what he did for a living, and with great importance, the guy said that he sold tickets at a movie theater. He wanted the plumber to do quiet work, dusting or whatever, until the early afternoon, and start with the loud stuff at around 3. Everyone has a plan, except for the workmen, who show up whenever they want to. I turned on the TV last night and was delighted to find Cops, which translates to It's Worth the Detour. It was dubbed in French, but still you could hear faint bits of English in the background. He claims, the suspect, knucklehead. The first segment involved a long, high-speed chase along a California freeway. The driver was shirtless, and you could tell he took great pride in his feather-cut, shoulder-length blonde hair. When he was dragged from the car, his first impulse was to comb it out with his fingers and then gently fluff it up. He was the kind of guy you'd see hanging out at Atlantic Beach, and I wondered what the French would make of him. Who do they think our criminals are? Mexicans were behind the wheel in the next high-speed chase, and because they were juveniles, their faces were covered with diamond patterns. My favorite segment involved a truck driver wearing a leopard print, one-piece woman's bathing suit. Someone had apparently taken his wallet, but I couldn't understand the details. I'm hoping that Cops comes on every night, and that the French will eventually develop their own version. Who are the criminals here? I have absolutely no idea. August 1st. Last night on Arte, I watched part of a documentary about a gang of adolescents living on the streets of some African city. The boys slept in a little room made of cardboard, and spent most of the time huffing glue and looking for things to steal. At one point, they offered protection to a prostitute, and when she rejected their offer, they threatened to kill her. They were just kids, but there were a lot of them, and that gave some weight to their threat. Hugh and I had plans to go to a 10 o'clock movie, and while we were walking down the Rue des Écoles, I imagined that I could take the gang of boys to a restaurant. "Anywhere you want to go," I'd say. I imagined them eating until they were full, and then I pictured them stealing the silverware and the salt and pepper shakers. The theater was hot, and after the movie started, I realized I'd seen it 2 years ago. It was Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be, starring Jack Benny and Carol Lombard as a couple of Polish actors. 15 minutes into the movie, Warsaw gets bombed, and again I felt sissy-ish and spoiled. I'm supposed to be enjoying this new apartment, but I can't help but feel guilty for the fancy oven and brand new washer and dryer. We sit around like people in a magazine, but it's not the sort of magazine I would ever subscribe to. August 7th. On the train to Florence, a man entered the subway car and said he was unemployed and needed money. He was tall and out of shape, with greasy hair cut like Sir Lancelot's. On the train back, a different man, slighter and more desperate, crawled down the aisle on his hands and knees, stopping every few feet to hold up his hands in prayer, saying, "Please, oh please, won't you help me?" It's pretty rare for French metro beggars to single you out personally. Generally, they enter the train, make a speech, and then move through the car with their hands held out. The crawling man pleaded with a woman, and when she turned away, he popped out the upper plate of his dentures, proving that he was even more pathetic than he looked. He crawled over to me, and when I gave him 10 francs, he asked if he could also have my pen. It's the small aluminum Muji ballpoint I keep inside my police notebook. He said he needed it in order to write a letter to his wife, and when I said no, he gave me a hateful look. August 9th. The other night, I went to the Action Ecole to see Stardust Memories. It was raining, and just as I stepped beneath the narrow awning, an attractive young woman asked if she could use my umbrella. She said she needed to get something from her car and that she'd be right back. It seemed ungentlemanly to say no, so I handed it over, figuring I'd never see it again. The line was short, and after buying my ticket, I waited out front. People walked up and down the street, and I realized I'd completely forgotten what this young woman looked like. I could pass her tomorrow and never know that this was the person who'd stolen my $70 umbrella. I waited for 5 minutes and was just about to give up when she ran into the theater with a bag in her hand saying, "Thank you so much, and you were so nice." In the theater, I took a seat against the wall. There were people in the middle of the aisle, 3 Americans who did nothing as I tried to pass. I mean, they didn't even pull in their legs. It was like I was invisible. I always stand when someone passes and naturally expect others to do the same. Just before the movie started, a tall guy took a seat in front of me. I had to lean to the left in order to see the screen, and during the 2 hours, I seemed to have pulled a muscle in my back. It feels like I've been shot, and the exit wound is right below my left shoulder blade. I'm blaming the 3 Americans who refused to stand as I took my seat. Had they been more cooperative, I would have moved and spared myself this pain. I mean, it really hurts. August 12th, Edinburgh, Scotland. The RER crawled to De Gaulle and stopped for 20 minutes at Errigar 1, so we missed our afternoon flight to Edinburgh. I don't remember the last time I missed a plane, and it took me a while to get beyond the shock of it. For the rest of the afternoon, I thought, if only we'd left sooner, if only we'd hailed a cab. It always helps that Hugh takes these things a lot harder than I do. He decided that fine, he'd just stay home, and it took a while for me to change his mind. There was another flight at 9, and the woman at the desk gave me the last ticket. Hugh was put on standby and promised that if he made it on board, he'd never complain again. Those were his words, never again. I drew up a little contract, and he signed it. I now have it in writing. If I, Hugh Hamrick, get a seat on tonight's flight, I will never complain again. He got his seat, and every 5 minutes I pulled out the contract and gloated. It was a small plane. Our flight attendant was named Daisy, and she served us a frozen dinner featuring a slab of meat and some sort of gelled rice concoction. When I say frozen, I don't mean thawed or reheated, I mean frozen. Hugh's rice concoction was impenetrable, and my meat was trimmed in ice. I was free to complain all I wanted, but having signed the contract, he could do nothing but smile and chip away at his rock-hard brownie. August 13th, Perth, Scotland. On the BBC's recommendation, we visited a coastal town called North Berwick. It was a small place with a wide beach, offering a view of several craggy islands set a half mile out to sea. I call it the sea, but according to Hugh, it was actually the Firth of Forth, a cove. North Berwick was noted in our guidebook for its handsome public toilets, which were decorated with flowers, and little signs asking you to keep the place clean. Lunch was taken at the Buttercup Cafe. At the table next to ours sat two white-haired women, one of whom was blind and carried a folding cane. The blind woman talked a lot, and as she spoke, her bored friend looked out into the street, saying they'd better get going before the rain started.
"I'm used to the rain," the blind woman said. "If I let the weather stop me, I'd never get anywhere."
She buttoned her coat and then settled back in her seat to finish her tea. Our meals arrived, and just as we started eating, the blind woman decided it was time to go. She rose from her chair, collected her purse, and farted in Hugh's face. It was a small trumpeting sound that was talked about for the rest of the day. August 17th, Paris. Yesterday, outside the movie theater, I saw a Japanese albino. He was a young man in his late 20s with hair and skin the color of cotton balls. Maybe it was due to his pale skin, but his teeth looked really yellow. They were crooked, too, and crammed into his mouth. He had a rash covering his jaw, and a half a dozen tattooed stars burned into his arm. The poor guy was just a mess. It was 4:30 in the afternoon, and I was at the Saint-Germain-des-Prés to see Love Streams, which was playing as part of their Essential Cassavetes series. His movies are often too long and sometimes dull. When Gina Rollins is on screen, I'm in heaven, and when she goes away, I sit in the dark and think about other things, the Japanese albino, for instance. I've been here for 3 years, but still won't stop a stranger to ask for a match. People ask me all the time, but I just can't seem to do it myself. Neither can I walk into Fnac and ask where I might find a certain CD. Instead, I just roam around, not even knowing which genre it's under. In French record stores, the CDs are grouped under strange headings, many of which include the word black. I believe they have a section called Black Rage. After looking at Fnac, I walked to Montparnasse to catch the 96 bus. I could have just as easily walked home, but I thought it might be fun to visit the train station with no luggage. August 18th. I walked into the kitchen this morning to find a pigeon sitting on top of the cabinet above the sink. There were always dozens of them roosting on the ledges of the surrounding buildings, and I was surprised one hadn't come in sooner. I don't know how long the pigeon had been here or what she'd done with her time alone. I spilled some couscous on the counter last night and found it was still there, so I'm guessing she didn't have the opportunity to eat. I'm no expert, but it seems that pigeons would like couscous. Yesterday I had my picture taken by an American named Anthony. He's been in Paris for 17 years, and his girlfriend just had a baby, which has changed his life. "It's different now," he said. "When you're single, you maybe have an affair and your girlfriend decides to break up with you. So it's painful, but you just go out and find someone else. It seems to me that if you're having an affair, the person being cheated on has dibs on the word painful, but I didn't say anything. Anthony has done a lot of work in Russia and used to keep an apartment in Moscow. Those Russian women will destroy you," he said. He's trying to be a family man, but I don't have much faith that it will work out. September 12th. Last night on TV, I watched people jump from the windows of the World Trade Center. I watched the towers fall in on themselves. I watched the burning Pentagon. And then I watched people jump from the windows of the World Trade Center. From my kitchen, office, and living room windows, I saw my neighbors watching the same thing, each with a remote in one hand and a telephone in the other. It felt like everyone in the world was in front of the TV. Now it's the next day, and I still haven't gotten it through my head. The thing that